I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate today. March 22, this Saturday, has been dedicated as World Water Day. And so today on Underreported, we're going to check in on a couple of stories about water issues throughout the world. In most places, the burden usually falls to women to find and manage water for home use. So it's important for planners to involve women in developing sustainable water plans. With me now for today's Underreported is Patricia Dandinoli, who is CEO of WaterAid America, who's here with me in the studio.
Hello.
And Lydia Zigomo, who is a human rights lawyer from Zimbabwe, who serves as WaterAid's head of region for East Africa and is the chairperson of the Zimbabwe Women's Network. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, Lydia and Patricia, why does the task of collecting water usually fall to women?
Well, the task is part of traditional societies, and so because women tend to be responsible for cooking and caring for children, it is a natural task for them to also be responsible for collecting and managing water within the family.
And this is probably not a question that can be answered with a blanket answer, but what does collecting water entail?
Well, in effect, it means walking to wherever the nearest water source is. In some cases, that is several kilometers away and often takes several hours each day. Some people estimate as much as 25% of the day for women to walk to a very unsafe, unprotected water source like a spring or a river in which animals might be bathing or might have run off from agricultural pesticides, things like that. And so they would literally walk carrying a bucket or some kind of a vessel and carry back whatever they could possibly manage in their hands, on their head. And they would make that trip several times a day. So that's what it means.
Could I also add there?
Yes, Lydia.
That it's actually interesting when you talk to some of the communities that it also means that sometimes they don't even get enough sleep. Women and girls sometimes queue in the night to be able to get to that water point on time. So there will be queues for quite a long distance of women who are waiting to collect water. So because there are so few water points in some of these communities. So that, for instance, a young girl may wake up at 4 a.m. to go and queue for the water, to collect the water. So she walks a few kilometers, collects it after standing in the queue for a few hours, comes back, cleans the house, and then is expected to go to school and actually be able to pay attention in school and produce good results.
So all of this happens before even the girl has to go to school?
Yes. And we have also found that there are cases where when they go to these water points, for instance, in Ethiopia, in certain parts of Ethiopia, they have to climb down to get to the water. So the water is not just on the surface of the ground. Sometimes if it's an unprotected source that Pat was talking about, it could be on rocky or sandy ground. And they climb down with no aids to actually scoop the water into their buckets. And in one case, in 1 month, four women were killed by collapsing rocks from that structure that actually fell on them while they were down trying to scoop water in this water source.
In these communities, is there anything that can be done to lessen this burden on women, or is this just because of the area where they're living, say, with these deep wells, this is the only way to get water?
Well, no. I mean, what we do, WaterAid does, is we work to bring water much more much closer to the communities where women live. You opened the story, the show, by talking about involving women in the planning, and it's very important to consult with women about where they would like their water points to be in the community. But by either drilling a well or tapping a spring, you can bring as Lydia was describing, a community water point into a village so that women may not need to walk that distance. I mean, that's the ideal.
How difficult is it to do that? Is it something where when you come to a particular community, they will embrace you and say, yes, let's do this? Or is it something where you have steps that you need to go through in order to be able to to help them embrace the idea?
Well, I'll let Lydia answer in more detail, but what I'd like to say is that WaterAid works with local organizations and local partners. So it wouldn't be the case that WaterAid would present itself to a village and say, well, here we are, we're going to give you water. We work with civil society, with community members themselves, and therefore we're there as a support, as a funder, if you will, to facilitate their work. And Lydia might be able to talk more specifically about how we do that.
Yes, I think what we do normally is you'll find that when we go into communities, we will have done some mapping of where the need may be in a particular district or geographical area, looking at certain statistical information that you can get. And then based on that, we go into the communities, identify the local organizations that are working there, and have community dialogues and community sort of outreach processes, where communities themselves will be asked to indicate what are the areas of need in that community. And often one of the biggest things they will raise that's top on their priorities is access to water. And having done that, we then do things like, these days we also look at doing things like water point mapping, which is an exercise of actually working with the community and local government and local organizations working in that community to go around and map what is the available water sources to that community. And that information can be very powerful for the community to use to show the local government that actually they have no source of water nearby in terms of what the government has prescribed as proper access to water for communities. So we will do that type of work. And then we will also work with the community to say what are the types of things they can contribute in terms of delivery of that water. So it's not just us doing things for the community. The community will use their own labor, trenches, and that will help the piped water to get to their communities. So they actually do quite a lot and are involved in quite a big way in terms of ensuring that access to the water actually happens for themselves.
Are there new ways now of getting water to areas that may not have a water table underneath them? I mean, you talked about, Lydia, about piping the water in. What are the different ways now of helping communities, as you say, get water at a point where it's more accessible to them?
Well, in most places, groundwater is available, and we rely often on groundwater sources. And so that might be a shallow well, or in some cases where the groundwater, the water table is low, a deeper well. But because of variability these days in rainwater and in water itself, we do look for supplementary and alternative sources such as rainwater harvesting. But typically, we can rely on groundwater sources because the need for water for household use, for drinking and cooking and bathing, is relatively small compared to the uses that agriculture and business might have for water.
And your focus is exclusively on the domestic use of water.
Absolutely, yes. And we particularly focus on the needs of the poorest communities, because what you'll find is even in very poor countries, those who are relatively better off will often have a much higher rate of access to water than the very poor in those countries. So our target population, if you will, are the very poor, marginalized communities, HIV, AIDS sufferers, the elderly.
Lydia, how did you get involved in this kind of work? You're a human rights lawyer. What drew you to water as an issue?
I think what interested me was actually realizing that often human rights lawyers, and there are human rights activists in many of these countries, we tend to focus on civil and political rights, so the issues around rights to vote and those kind of rights. But actually, if we are not also looking at what the economic social rights of people are and meeting their basic needs, then the right to vote can be superfluous. But also showing the linkage between access to basic services and people using and holding their governments to account, so using their ability to demand from their local government and national governments that they deliver the minimum basic services. So that's there's a very strong rights focus, actually, in terms of how services are delivered to people. And I think that was what attracted me to it, that you could actually see the law and human rights and the potential to use them to also ensure that people have at least the basic services in terms of water, sanitation, health, education, etc., shelter, that should be realized by their government.
And that the essential needs need to be addressed first before these other needs can be discussed.
Because a person who doesn't have food and who hasn't got clean water is obviously going to fall sick. And if they're sick, they're not productive, but also they can't participate in the public life of the country. So they're not going to be able to have any ability to think about demanding their rights from government or even making sure that their governments function properly and are democratic.
We've been talking about access to water, where it comes from. Is also the cleanliness of water and the potability of water an issue in these places?
Well, yes. We do also do careful monitoring of water quality. There are often cases where there are some naturally occurring substances such as fluoride, or I'm sure you've heard of arsenic in the water in Bangladesh, where we definitely need to take care that the water is safe. But generally speaking, I would say that unless there has been some contamination, the groundwater is usually, unless it's something like arsenic or fluoride, which is another chemical that we have to look out for. Generally, again, if you're looking at protected sources, generally okay. But Lydia might have more thoughts on this too. She's been out in the field.
We also, in places like India, are looking at ways of how you also deal with arsenic or fluoride. So where they are occurring in Tanzania, India, and a few other places, how do you actually address arsenic and fluoride? And can it be done in low-cost ways so that that is readily available to communities? They can, whether it's something you put, a chemical you put to cleanse the water or some other process you do, can it be a low-cost, easily accessible method that the communities can use to clean their own water? But we also look at trying to ensure that the water is safe from point of source. Mm-hmm. So we would do studies before we drill to ensure that the place we're doing that, the water that's going to be coming from there, is actually safe for people to consume. We do that as a preliminary exercise.
I just would add, picking up on something that Lydia just said, I think it's important to stress that the type of technologies that we're talking about are very, very, very basic, because the communities where we're working don't have access to materials or supplies from the developed world. And so the pumps that we help install have to be made of locally available materials. Water treatment really needs to be kept to a minimum and in a way that's extremely affordable for local communities. And so we don't really get involved with very fancy filtration and treatment plants, and that doesn't seem to be the biggest issue. Water is, I've been told, I'm not a scientist, but I've been told that you can actually make water safe to drink and purify it sufficiently by putting it in a clear plastic container on a rooftop for 24 hours, and that solar energy would actually make it potable if there's no chemical contamination.
Last year I spoke with a scientist, Rita Colwell, who focuses on cholera. And she found in Bangladesh that if she could get women to fold their saris into four, mm-hmm. and pour the water through it, that was all they needed to do, because the cholera attached to larger bits, and they were able then to have drinking water. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it is wonderful when you can find resources mm-hmm. that are right there. Lydia, I know we're talking to you in England right now, but I wonder if you can tell us about a particular village or a particular story of a place where you came in and were able to see change and make change happen.
Well, I'll mention one particular one in Tanzania, since I've just come from there, so that's the one that's very clear in my mind. I actually was visiting a project that WaterAid had worked on with the community and the local government of that area. And it was in a rural community. And we worked there 10 years ago and helped the local government and the community to rehabilitate a water scheme. So these are water schemes which the government of Tanzania put in to communities in the 70s. but have fallen into disuse and are not being repaired because people were never taught how to maintain these water sources. And they can cater for quite large numbers of people. So the issue is not that they're not there, but that they're not functioning. So what we did when we came in, the community said, look, we have this thing, but it's not working. It was a community of, it's a community of about 6,000 or so people. And within that community, there's a school and also a health center. So the water would be useful not just for household consumption, but for also the local clinic and the school. And they worked on this project with the community and brought in a diesel engine pump to actually pump the water and also built a container so that the water could be stored. I think thousands of liters, actually tens of thousands of liters can be stored. Then they worked with the community to link that water scheme to different water points that were identified by the women and other sort of vulnerable groups, disabled, etc., in that community, as to where it would be most useful to have the taps that where the piped water would come in, so that clusters of households would have access very easily within less than 30 minutes to a water source. And at the school, they also looked at rainwater harvesting as well as access to the water. So the rainwater harvesting is storing the water on the roof and in the clinic. But they also have access to this water scheme that is there. And it was interesting to come back 10 years later and see a community that is still has been so empowered by that scheme. They have their own water users committee. Women are very active and participating a lot in that community. They're in key positions within that community. The person who was actually maintaining the diesel engine pump for the water is a woman. So she's now a private sector sort of contractor, subcontracted by the community to manage the scheme on their behalf. She has been able to employ people to do things like repairs, mechanics, etc. And the people who are manning or sort of in charge or attending to people when they come to get water from the water taps, quite a number of them are also women. So they were now able to earn a bit of money from that job. So it was interesting to see a project which enabled children to go to school because water was available at the school, enabled the clinic to function because water was available at the clinic, and was also ensuring that each household had access to water. And as a result, more people were actually wanting to come into that village because it's functioning so well. And they were all talking about how diseases had gone down in that community, malaria, diarrhea, cholera, and how as a result of that, they're also doing things around sanitation, so building toilets for themselves. Hygiene promotion is very high in that community. So it has a sort of other effects, positive effects, when you get communities working on something like this that is tangible and they can see the results and the impact on their own lives.
It sounds like it embodies the reason you went into this work to begin with, is that...
Yes.
It's also, we have time for just one more question, and in what you're saying, Lydia, it sounds like this work has been going on for a long, long time, that these things were initially done in the 70s, but then it fell into disrepair. Has the approach changed in the way that aid workers come in and dig a well? Is
yes.
there a different way of doing it so yeah. that people can do it themselves?
Well, yes. I mean, as Lydia is saying, one of the things many agencies, including WaterAid, has learned is that it's very important that the community itself understand, be involved in planning as well as in management. So, yes, we work very closely. We not only focus on what we would call the hardware, but what we call the software, which is
the people.
Is the people themselves. Yeah. And that's essential for sustainability.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today on the Leonard Lopate Show.
It's our pleasure.
I've been speaking.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Patricia Dandonoli, and she's the CEO of WaterAid America, and Lydia Zigomo, human rights lawyer from Zimbabwe. And Lydia, I know you're going to be here in New York this weekend to be
yes,
part.
Yes, I'm arriving tomorrow.
Yes, and she will be part of the World Water Day at the Museum of Natural History. We also, on the Leonard Lopate Show's show page, we have more about WaterAid and a link to WaterAid's website. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.